Blessed is the flame. Caput FM.
playing.
Blessed is the
flame, flame, flame.
She gave me a piece of paper, and she said, if I don't survive, make sure that this piece of paper gets back to my fellow partner. And so she crosses the border, you know what happens? He takes the piece of paper, and he looks at it, and he says, oh. He says to himself, we're fighting a war here. Let's finish out when it's writing poetry. And he throws a piece of paper. And then a few minutes later, he realizes it's a wrong thing to do. This could have been one isolation. So he picks up the piece of paper, and on the piece of paper were the following words. Blessed is a match consumed in its own flame that kindles another. Blessed is a flame that burns in secret facets of the heart. Blessed is a heart with the strength to stop its beating for honor's sake. Blessed is the match that's consumed in its own flame that kindles another.
Illuminate. Illuminate. Blessed is the match. Blessed is the match.
Blessed is the
flame.
Blessed is the
flame.
Play.
Blessed is the
flame. Flame.
It burned brightly.
Blessed is the
flame.
May the flame that burns inside of us burn everything around us.
Illuminate. darkness. Illuminate
my eyes are flame. My heart is flame.
We're being led to our slaughter. This has been theorized in a thousand ways, described in environmental, social, and political terms. It has been prophesied, abstracted, and narrated in real time, and still we are unsure of what to do with it. The underlying point is that the progress of society has nothing to offer us and everything to take away. Often it feels like we are giving it away without a fight. When we sell our time for money, allow our passions to be commodified, invest ourselves in the betterment of society, or sustain ourselves on the spoils of ecological destruction. We openly, though not consensually, participate in our own destruction. The question hangs in an ethereal and ghastly voice. Why do you let yourselves be led to the slaughter like sheep? As Hermann Langbein addresses in Against All Hope, Resistance in the Nazi Concentration Camps, the survivors of those most explicit of human slaughterhouses have been plagued by that question for decades, to which some have simply replied, "We didn't." What can stories of resistance inside of the Nazi concentration camps teach us about our own situations? How can we relate to the resistance of those immersed in the most frightful and hopeless struggle the world has ever witnessed? Underneath the ubiquitous sheep to the slaughter metaphor is buried a profound historical possibility. Wherever the Nazis sought to impose domination and violence, people resisted. Behind the images of people wearing armbands, boarding trains, and walking placidly into gas chambers lies a rich history of recalcitrance and insurrection. Inside the Nazi concentration camps, places meticulously designed to subjugate and exterminate human beings, people organized, conspired, sabotaged, and reflexively fought back against their oppressors. Though there are certainly lessons to be taken from World War II about the potential for whole populations to be rendered docile, There are also lessons about what it means to defy pacification and extraordinarily bleak circumstances. When we forget these kinds of stories, we forget about our own capacities for resistance. A different approach. We have already been led to our slaughter. It is all around us. The world in which we exist is a protracted death, a sort of economically sustained limbo, in which hearts are permitted to beat only to the extent that they can facilitate the upward stream of capital. The plague of domestication has reached into every wild space, and the lines of colonization have crossed us more times than we can count. Every unproductive aspect of the biosphere has been flagged for eradication, from the beam-thralled ocean floors to the dynamited reefs to the hollowed-out mountains. The highest calibers of technology are locked into a perpetual killing spree, chugging along in a monotonous rhythm of death. We who still have air in our lungs are the living dead, and struggle daily to remember what it feels like to be alive. Holding tightly to the desire for wildness that the misery of a paycheck cannot allay. We roam the desolate architecture of our slaughterhouses, the prison of civilization we live in. Like ghosts who feel but cannot quite understand the vapity of our existence. To borrow some apt phrases from the conspiracy of cells of fire, we've become thoroughly integrated into a system that crushes us on a daily basis, that controls our thoughts and our desires through screens, and teaches us how to be happy slaves. While letting us consider ourselves free, we can vote and consume, and all the while, we, like cheerful Sisyphus, are still carrying our slavery stone and think this is life. As an American Iraq War veteran turned strategy consultant wrote in the New York Times in 2013, the biggest problem we face is a philosophical one. Understanding that this civilization is already dead. The extent to which we have internalized the rhythms, values, and stories of the civilization ties our future to this undead and all-devouring system. Then perhaps a better question might be, why are we continuously being led to our slaughter like sheep? To which many of us simply reply, we aren't. We aren't.
revenge.
Kill somebody.
Revenge.
Beat up Nazi officials.
Revenge.
Attack.
Revenge.
Their rage is their dignity.
I began thinking about this text in Toronto, where my 92-year-old grandmother lived on the 7th floor of a high-rise apartment overlooking Highway 401. Standing at the floor-to-ceiling windows in her kitchen, the horizon is swallowed by 12 lanes of concrete and an endless river of traffic, equal parts terrifying and hypnotic. How many gruesome stories are written into this one landscape. The concrete road tells the story of the colonization of Turtle Island. The commuter traffic tells the story of mass domestication under the rhythms of capitalism. The billowing smog tells the story of the future that's almost too frightening to believe. Drinking tea quietly, my grandmother is severely unfazed by this ominous procession. It is the world she now knows and accepts. In a previous chapter of her life, she confronted and survived the very different infrastructure of death. As a young adult, the bunkers, factories, and crematorium of Auschwitz defined nearly a year of her life. Her experiences of the Nazi Holocaust sit close with me as I look out over this glowing ribbon of death and wrestle with the ideas of nihilism. To what extent do I remain attached to this society that I despise? What would it mean to sever those attachments? If this were Nazi Germany expanding out before me, how would I live my life? What if I were in my grandmother's position in 1943? What does it mean to resist against such a catastrophically extensive and overwhelming system? I'm interested in the sort of resistance we pursue, not because we necessarily believe it will produce desired changes or lead us into a brighter future, but because it is the most meaningful response to this attack we can imagine. Because we simply can't stomach the idea of being passive in the face of a system this brutal, regardless of how far we may be from our dreams. Nihilism urges anarchists to embrace our feelings of cynicism around radical milieus, our feelings of boredom with prescribed methods of resistance, our feelings of hopelessness in the current landscape of domination, and to engage in forms of revolt that cultivate immediate joy and moments of liberation. And that's where the Nazi Holocaust becomes particularly interesting. Concentration camp resistance challenges nihilism to consider just how bleak it is willing to get. The resistance of those in the lagers who were deprived of every vestige of hope, every morsel of inspiration and every shred of comfort, poses rich questions about how much hopelessness we are willing to wade through for a chance to fight back. It reminds us that resistance is not just about getting results, but about our reflexive reactions to oppressive situations. Whether we succeed in overthrowing our oppressors and bringing about a brighter future can only be secondary to the visceral need to rebel against the shitty conditions of our lives. Both topics, anarcho-nihilism and concentration camp resistance, challenge anarchists to realize a spirit of resistance that can endure horrific conditions, that can weather the storms of absolute futility, and that can still muster an exuberant desire to rebel.
Rebel.
Sabotage in the lagers. To begin, some acts of sabotage were targeted directly in the modes of production within the Nazi war economy. Steel plates used for constructing tanks were mysteriously buried under rubber. Key materials were misplaced. Tools and bricks were accidentally damaged. And perfect good airplane motors were deemed damaged and sent to the junkyard. Entire stockpiles of ammunition were dumped into lakes, shipments of fuel were poured out onto the ground, and salt was added to gunpowder by the women of Ravensbrück, rendering it useless. In Flöha, French engineers constructed excessively heavy airplane wings that would pass inspection but certainly cause problems in the air. In Auschwitz, women sabotaged the production of plant-based rubber by simply burning half of the harvested seeds. Ships coming out of the Chastram engine factory were improperly welded. Grenades coming out of a factory near Auschwitz failed to explode, and machine guns produced by inmates of Mauthausen were completely dysfunctional. Rockets produced in Dora had inexplicable quantities of urine in their electronic components, courtesy of the Russian inmates. In 1943, a Polish inmate named Jan Sot was able to sabotage large quantities of anti-aircraft missiles by shifting the precise alignment of the detonators ever so slightly, resulting in 2 months' worth of faulty weapons. Maria Jakubowicz recalls her crew's habitual sabotage of the production of oil bombs. We sabotaged whenever we could by simply not inserting the fuses into the bombs. When they realized it, we of course got 25 blows with a club, but we would still do it nonetheless. One woman who was put to work in Auschwitz fixing the piles of clothes taken from incoming Jews reports, "We sabotaged work in a way that we made clothes unusable on purpose." A woman in Bolzenburg who was put to work in an airplane factory reports, "We sabotaged work in whatever ways we could. We broke the drills, presses, and everything that could appear to have happened by accident." Because some inmates were put to work as bureaucrats, a great deal of sabotage could be accomplished from behind a desk with nothing more than a stroke of a pen. With this method, unskilled workers were deemed experts and sent to do important work on the factory line, while those with valuable skills were sent to dig trenches. On the other hand, skilled workers who could be trusted to do sabotage work were handpicked for specific jobs in which they could cause maximum damage. A third tactic involved fudging roll call numbers such that some inmates were simply overlooked by the ESS and spared from work for days at a time. In at least one situation, a doctor falsely diagnosed an entire work crew with typhus in order to have them all put on quarantine and delay the delivery of an urgent order of weapons. Organized sabotage efforts often united people of different nationalities and political ideologies towards a common goal. In one case, 2,000 inmates who established a Polish, Russian, German sabotage group at a mine in Jasowice tore their conveyor belts, hit the tips of mining drills, and instead of coal, loaded stones. In another case, 400 Russian and German political prisoners working at the Henkelwerke aircraft plant conspired to use magnetized wires to disorient plane navigation systems. The workers were able to sabotage an entire fleet of aircraft without the inspectors finding any faults. Out of a total of 120 aircraft assembled, not a single one was fit for use. In some cases, organized sabotage efforts were successful in creating larger scale disruptions by undermining entire infrastructure projects. In the spring of 1942, when the crematorium of Dachau was deemed unfit, the camp management ordered a larger one to be built complete with its own ovens and gas chamber. The German capo in charge of the project was a communist and intent on hindering the construction effort. His instruction to the workers was to the tune of, "Comrades, the gas chamber through which all of us may be intended to march must never be finished. Work slowly? No. Sabotage whatever you can." Though they did complete the crematorium, the cement did not bond properly, the foundation turned out to be too weak, and the mortar in the brickwork crumbled so that the whole unit had to be torn down and put up again. The second construction was rushed and the ESS was forced to abandon the extra gas chamber.
Sabotage.
Sabotage.
The weapon
to be attacked.
Sabotage.
Interested in fire.
Sabotage.
Engaged in the practice.
Attack.
Burn, kill, etc.
Pure negation. The passion for destruction is a creative passion too. Mikhail Bakunin. It is ridiculous to even contemplate coexisting with this fascist apparatus. It all has to be destroyed to start afresh. We will taste the fruits from the trees we've grown ourselves in the ashes of their empire. Anonymous, incitement to burn. The call from Bakunin to embrace the destructive urge forms the backbone of both anarchist and anarcho-nihilist thought. The latter takes this axiom and runs with it, arguing that in the face of global systems of domination, our sole aim should be to destroy all that constitutes those systems. This stands in direct contrast to other anarchist tendencies that place at least some emphasis on positive programs. Aspirations to construct something ideal in the present world or to craft plans in preparation for the downfall of the current system. Anarcho-nihilism understands the positive program as one that confuses desire with reality and extends that confusion into the future. By either making promises about what a revolutionary future might hold, or attempting to bring those conditions about from with the existing order. Such positive aspirations offer nothing more than a dangling carrot for us to pursue in a situation in which the stick, string, and prize all need to be destroyed. The example of those living under Nazi rule illustrates a situation in which, for those deemed ballast existenzen, positive visions were unfathomable. Establishing long-term projects to alternative infrastructure would be ludicrous, except to the extent that they facilitated the destruction of the existing order. So long as Hitler reigned, no Jewish commune would be tolerated, no anarchist child care collective could ever hope to thrive. To be immersed in a social order as violent and controlling as Nazi Germany warranted the reaction of absolute hostility. Attacks aimed at every level of society. Pure negation. So too does anarcho-nihilism understand the existing order of today as without potential for a positive agenda. Whatever we build within its bounds will be co-opted, destroyed, or turned against us. We understand that only when all that remains of the dominant techno-industrial capitalist system is smoldering ruins, is it feasible to ask, what next? According to this line of thought, our situation today is similar to the Lagers to the extent that positive projects, attempts to create a world in the shell of the old, are simply out of place.
Annihilated.
Prison members of the CCF write, "We anarcho-nihilists don't talk about transformation of social relations. Towards a more liberated view, we promulgate their total destruction and absolute annihilation. Only through total destruction of the current world of power will it be possible to build something new. The deeper we destroy, the more freely will we be able to build."
time away.
Do you know how one says never in camp slang? Morgen früh. Tomorrow morning. Primo lady. Spontaneous resistance sometimes. One of the connections that jumped out at me early in my research was the continuous reference to time in both anarcho-nihilist and Holocaust literature. While Heflinger described horrific experiences of the obliteration of time, nihilists often call for unmitigated attacks against time itself. No future has become something of a dark motto.
Attack.
Time.
Though the most well-known acts of physical resistance against the Nazis were planned and coordinated actions, there were also countless unplanned attacks that plagued the Nazi thirst for order and obedience. Of the stories that have been passed down to us, scant details survive. Some of these stories are patched together from multiple partial witnesses, while others were merely inferred from the silences they created. These acts of spontaneous resistance resonate deeply with anarcho-nihilism. For nowhere else does the rallying cry of no future apply as well as to those who responded to utterly hopeless situations with acts of fierce abandon.
Revenge.
Inmates who physically confronted their oppressors were not engaged in a rational political struggle for a better future, but others stood the futility of their situations and those to fight back regardless.
Revenge.
These moments can help us to understand what is at stake in our rethinking of time and what it might mean for us to sever ourselves from oppressive chronological modes.
Burn, kill. Time.
Right now.
Spontaneous resistance in the lagers. In Treblinka on August 26, 1942, when a young Jewish man wasn't permitted to say goodbye to his mother, he wrestled a knife from a Ukrainian guard and stabbed him. The man and everyone else on his transport was shot. On September 11, 1942, after watching his wife and child be selected for the gas chambers in Treblinka, Mayor Berliner attacked an SS man with a knife, stabbed him to death and leaving the knife protruding from his back. Berliner and over 100 of his fellow inmates were cruelly killed. In 1942, as 1,500 Polish Jews were being escorted off a train at Auschwitz, a Jewish capo named Morris discreetly informed some of them that they were being led to their death. Unrest spread throughout the crowd and eventually turned into an attack against the SS guards. 40 members of Morris's commando joined in the fight. The entire transport and commando were killed. On October 17, 1944, Hannah Levi Hass, an inmate of Bergen-Belsen, whose diary survived the war, recorded that her camp was put on severe lockdown and that rumors had circulated about the women's rebellion in the neighboring camp. The only evidence of this rebellion for Levi Hass was the cessation of all regular camp activity and the go of the crematorium, which operated non-stop throughout the night. On the night of February 1st, 1945, a group of Russian and British prisoners of war, as well as 19 Luxembourg policemen who refused to join the SS, rebelled as they were being led out of Sachsenhausen to be executed in a surrounding forest. One inmate managed to wrestle a gun away from a guard and fatally shoot him. All of the inmates were subsequently killed by SS machine gun fire. In late 1942 at Treblinka, a transport of around 2,000 Jews refused to enter the gas chamber. Those who yelled out indications of resistance were beaten, but the call was heard and no one budged. At one point, some of them rushed the SS and fighting with knives and bottles injured three guards. Somehow during the scuffle, a hand grenade exploded that also injured a guard. The entire transport was shot. Twice in 1943, the train station at Sobibor saw spontaneous rebellions by inmates who fought with stones, pots and bottles against armed guards. One of these scuffles saw several guards injured. In both cases, all inmates involved were killed. Also in Sobibor, Richard Raschke informs us that a group of women, many of whom held children, realized that they weren't being taken to a normal shower and became unruly, attacking the guards with bare hands. The SS sprayed them with machine guns. Those they missed were stuffed into the gas chambers. Philipp Müller tells a deeply disturbing story of a small group of Jewish families who, after hiding in dugouts in southern Poland for 4 months, were discovered and brought to Birkenau to be killed. As in many other stories, one mother dedicated her final moments to comforting her infant daughter, even as they were led to a wall to be shot by a Nazi named Voss. Müller watched as the two performed a macabre dance, Voss circling, trying to figure out where best to shoot the infant, while the mother reflexively turned to keep her daughter away from the barrel of the gun. Eventually, Voss grew frustrated and shot the child 3 times. As he turned his gun to the mother, she lost all self-control and flung her daughter straight at her murderer's head. Stunned, Voss wiped the blood off his face and dropped his gun, clearly unable to carry on. Another guard quickly took over and finished the job. Mala Zimetbaum, who became a well-known name in Birkenau for her selfless organizing in the camp and for her spectacular escape with a Polish lover, cemented her legendary status when, after being captured and brought back to the camp, she used her last moments under the gallows to defy the Nazis. Before the SS could put the noose around her neck, she cut her own vein with a small razor and, in the presence of all her fellow inmates, hit an SS man in the face with her bleeding hand. Olga Langel, who worked during her time in Birkenau smuggling parcels for a resistance organization, has a different recollection of what is the same to them. She recalls that a woman had escaped with a Polish lover using stolen SS uniforms, but was recaptured and brought back to the camp. When the Nazis tried to parade her around the camp, wearing a placard labeling her as an escapee, as part of her punishment, she resisted and was beaten severely, though she was able to land at least one punch on the guard's face. In addition to this astonishing show of defiance, Langel recalls that as the woman, near lifeless body, was being loaded onto a truck to be taken to the gas chambers, she yelled, "Courage, friends, they will pay. Liberation is near." On October 23, 1943, 1,700 Jews transported from Warsaw to Auschwitz were escorted to the gas chambers. When about two-thirds of them had already been taken to the chamber, a rebellion broke out among the remaining several hundred who were in the undressing room. Of what unfolded, only foggy, sometimes contradictory details survive. Four armed SS officers entered the undressing room. One of them was disarmed by a woman and fatally shot. The other inmates were spurred into action. They cut the electric wires and attacked the other guards. A shootout ensued between the guards at the door and the inmates, and ultimately all of the remaining inmates were let out and shot. In one version of the story, the woman was an actress named Katerina Horowitzova, and she retaliated after SS-man Josef Schillinger told her to remove her bra. She whipped off her garment and startled him by hitting him with it in his eyes. While he was blinded by pain, she grabbed his revolver and shot him and another guard. In another version, her retaliation came after Schillinger told her to dance naked. In another, the woman was named Francesca Mann, and she retaliated when Schillinger snatched the bra off her body. In yet another telling, the woman was an unnamed dancer who intentionally seduced the SS man while she was undressing, and while they ogled her, she smashed one of them in the forehead with her high heel and then disarmed and shot Schillinger and one other guard. The incident gave rise to legends and reminded inmates that SS men were also mortal. Rumors about the rebellion quickly spread throughout the camp and inspired another act of resistance later that same day, of which even less is known. The sole witness of this incident was privy only in the aftermath, the sight of strewn corpses in front of Crematorium 4. The fact that the bodies were still clothed implies that a group of inmates hadn't allowed themselves to be taken into their undressing room and were massacred. Each of these moments reflects a shattering of illusion, a fierce, visceral reaction to oppression, a desperate act in a totally hopeless situation. Liberation in these moments was not necessarily a material gain, but a fleeting lived experience, an existential reorientation from a relationship of domination to one of recalcitrance. Pure joy sense. Some of these attacks resonated widely outside of their perimeter and punctured holes in the Nazi facade of invulnerability, perhaps even inspiring others to fight back. Other attacks simply dissipated in a hail of gunfire. Regardless, each of them seemed to defy any notion of hope or strategy, and the very fact that each story ends with a mass slaughter gestures towards the spirit of resistance that prioritized lived revolt over futurity. In the concentration universe, as in the nihilist framework, conceptions of time become extremely important. How we understand time, its movement, and our place within it shapes how we understand the existing order and the potentials for resistance. While some anarchists have attempted to imagine how free people have conceived of different shapes of time itself, here we will solely be concerned with how oppressive modes of time are ruptured. For Häftlinge, this rupture involved breaking free from three states of chronological awareness: despondency, futurity, and the paralyzing suspension in the present. For anarcho-nihilists, focus has centered largely on breaking free from progressive conceptions of time and false senses of futurity. In both realms, we find an insurrectionary potential that exists outside of dominant modes of time. Walter Benjamin's concept of messianic time will offer us a vocabulary to describe this transgression. We begin in the concentration camps, where experiences of time were precarious and fraught with implications. In one sense, inmates were beckoned towards what we will call Lager time, which is the series of hoops and tribulations through which Nazis created the illusion of futurity, the promise of survival best encapsulated in the Auschwitz slogan, "Freedom through work." People were told that they were being taken to Sweden, but stepped out of the trains into Auschwitz. They were told they were being taken for delusing, but never left the crematorium. They were told that work would set them free, but they were literally worked to death. This ongoing promise of futurity kept many inmates docile in a system that ultimately produced only two things: German wealth and corpses. While the shattering of Lager time was seemingly the first step to resistance, such a rupture did not necessarily carry insurgent possibilities. For many, the abandonment of futurity simply meant despondency. Many souls were broken when the illusion of Lager time was peeled back to reveal an assembly line of death. For countless inmates, the alternative to futurity was the suicidal allure of the electric fence, which offered an immediate escape from the horror of despondency. Others experienced a complete disintegration of the mind and body. Such living dead creatures, those whose hearts still beat, but for whom death was a foregone conclusion, even had a name within the camps. While the Nazis actively fostered a myth of futurity through work and obedience, they simultaneously created the conditions of hopelessness, which for some was akin to death. For those who did not succumb to despair, the key to survival lay within the tension between Lager time and suicidal despondency. Throughout Holocaust memoirs, there is a sense of total immersion in the present, something we will call suspension. This experience involves the violent eradication of past and future, resulting in an unblinking commitment to survival in the present moment. From the Warsaw Ghetto we hear, "Everything taking place outside the ghetto walls becomes more and more foggy, distant, strange. Only the present day really mattered." From Auschwitz we hear, Why worry oneself trying to read into the future when no action, no words of ours could have the minimum influence? Our wisdom lay in not trying to understand. Not imagining the future, not tormenting ourselves as to how and when it would all be over. Not asking others or ourselves any questions. Survival meant forgetting about your past life, abandoning thoughts of future liberation, and sinking deeply into the eternal present. Survival meant thinking of today. In her diary from Bergen-Belsen, Hannah Levi-Haas reflects on her inability to remember anything about her life before the camps. The horror that surrounds us is so great that the brain becomes paralyzed and completely incapable of reacting to anything that doesn't stem directly from the nightmare we are presently living through, and this is constantly before our eyes. Soma Morgenstern, writing on the psychological impacts of the lagers, concludes that the key issue was the tyranny of the present, a tyranny that arose from the total uncertainty about the future and led to a destruction of the softest tissue of life, memory. The experience of suspension, a total immersion in the present moment, seemed to be the key to enduring the horrors of everyday life. In this state of suspension, however, resistance was still an impossibility. Imagine yourself walking a tightrope 500 feet in the air with a powerful strobe light held in front of your face. Are you worried about the future? Try remembering the past. Can you waste seconds thinking about the person who put you in this situation or how you might fight back against them? To survive even a moment in such a situation would require an intense, unblinking focus on the immediate present. This is the spell of suspension. This is how people endured the camps. Those in the camps who spontaneously fought back, knowing that death would be the immediate consequence, erupted out of oppressive, paralyzing, and illusory concept of time, and entered into this space of messianic time. Here I do not mean to argue that those who fought back in the lagers experienced some mystical chronological transcendence that granted them supernatural bravery. Rather, I am pointing towards the possibilities that exist when we confront our own futurelessness and find the will to act. When we don't believe the lies about where we are heading, when we don't sink into absolute despair about how fucked we are, and when we don't just keep our heads down and think about the present moment, when we step out of that debilitating sequence and act against the existing order, no matter the odds. This often means confronting death, imprisonment, alienation, and a variety of other dangers. For the anarcho-nihilist, it also means opening oneself up to new possibilities of being alive. These cries to stop time and to discover joy essence are essentially asking us to sever any attachment we have to the existing order and to position ourselves outside of and against its progress. So long as Häftlinge saw a future for themselves in the camps, or remained suspended in the present moment, or gave up on living completely, the Nazis would never have to deal with a moment of defiance. By shattering those chronological modes, some inmates broke with the rhythms of the camp and carved out a different fabric of time. Similarly, so long as we believe that this society is making progress, and so long as we can glimpse the future for ourselves within it, or a future for our children, we will remain in some way wed to it. When anarcho-nihilism urges us to abandon those chronological modes, it is in essence asking us to sever all ties to the continuation of society and work instead to negate its existence. In this rupture of time, we find a richness of life unimaginable within the existing order. Messianic time is a chronological awareness in which joy essence can flourish. For rather than deferring our rage to the future, we can finally realize that now, now is the time we've been waiting for. Now is the time we've been waiting for. Now is the time we've been waiting for.
Their rage is their dignity.
The cat.
Time.
Right now.
Dig it? Isn't it beautiful?
Yes.
All right.